Hi friends, my name is Kevin, and this is the Via Media Podcast. For many years now, there has been a scientific and spiritual revolution underway that is transforming both landscapes. This conceptual transformation celebrates the great scientific discoveries of our time and sees within the very fabric of nature itself all the foundational elements for the sacred. Our understanding of the natural world can evoke within us a sense of profound reverence and connection, a spiritual depth that is at the heart of the human experience. And this posture and worldview believes that the beautiful, wondrous, and scientific understandings of the natural world are essential foundations for our pursuit of personal wholeness, social coherence, and planetary sustainability. It is a captivating philosophical vision that aims to inspire us all to a new mode of being and a full embrace of the entirety of reality. Ursula Goodenough holds an MA in zoology from Columbia University and a PhD in biology from Harvard University. As one of the founders of the philosophy of religious naturalism, Ursula has served as president of the Institute on Religion in an Age of Science and is currently the president of the Religious Naturalist Association. Ursula is a professor emerita of biology at Washington University and the author of The Sacred Depths of Nature, first published in 1998 and newly released this year, 2023. Here is my conversation with Dr. Ursula Goodenough. Hey, good evening, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. Oh my goodness, I cannot tell you what an honor it is to introduce my guest, Ursula Goodenough. She holds a Master's of Arts in Zoology from Columbia University, PhD in biology, is a preeminent biologist, very well known for her work, and she has served as the president of the Institute on Religion in an Age of Science, and is currently the president of the Religious Naturalist Association, conveniently acronymed RNA. She is the Professor Emerita of Biology at Washington University and the author of this incredible book, The Sacred Depths of Nature, in its second edition, published this year in 2023, How Life Has Emerged and Evolved. Ursula, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I am so tremendously grateful to have you.
My pleasure.
Okay, so I wanted to just do a brief introduction. What I was sharing with you before we went live is I owe you an apology because I've been involved in the public and philosophic discourse between religion and science probably for a quarter century or more, and pulling my hair out as well as other people's hair out regarding what is or is not the absolute fundamental truth about both science and religion, their compatibility, incompatibility, noma, non-overlapping magisteria, and why one usurps the other and all this kind of stuff, and could never navigate my way through all of this stuff, I think successfully anyway. And I feel like, where in the world was Ursula Goodenough in my life 25 years ago, 30 years ago, and you were doing this very work and have written brilliantly about this difficult, challenging subject, but with such lucidity and clarity in bringing it all together. So what I'd like to do tonight, if it's okay with you, is I'd like to introduce my audience to this concept and the movement of religious naturalism and flesh out what it means and what it implies and how it works and then the journey that you've been on, because I feel like what you've provided for us is an incredible liberation from the contentiousness of our current public cultural discourse between these things. And we can actually have both, and not only have both, but we need both. So that's what I'd like to do tonight. Going through a lot, we're going to cover reductionism and teleology, the biological elements of emergence and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of what I have planned. Are you game for that, Ursula?
I'm up for it.
All
I'm
right.
Ready.
So let's just start with the basic question. Oh, and I just apologize. I'm coming off the a little bit of a chest cold. So I apologize for a little coughing every now and then. Let's go ahead and just start with the basics then. What is religious naturalism, and how did you come up with, that term, idea, and what does it mean to you in the work that you've been doing?
Okay, so let's start. I'd like to start by correcting your naturalism, because I've been trying very hard to get away from isms in general. People don't like them. I don't like them. And what we're talking about isn't an ism in the sense of a dogma, a creed, anything, school. And also the term naturalism is in fact one that describes the philosophical tradition of the 19th century that was very atheist and very uptight about religion not being anything that they had an interest in pursuing. So what we are calling it instead is a religious naturalist orientation. Orientation is a friendly word in our era, gender orientation or a sexual orientation. It's not it's not set in stone. It's something that guides you as you follow your path.
Good. Thank you for that.
So religious naturalist orientation is kind of a mouthful. So sometimes I lapse into religious naturalism because it's easier, but we also use the term RN for the abbreviation. Mm-hmm. And religious is different from religion. So I find I have to make that clear as well, that to my mind, a religion is kind of like an ism, in that, in fact, most religions do have isms like baptism and Catholicism, and they describe a fixed set of beliefs and practices, usually conducted in buildings with clerics and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And many people of our time, as we learn in every Pew survey, there are fewer and fewer people who feel an affinity with any particular religion and call themselves nuns, and have been at various times in their lives often traumatized or at least completely turned off by their religions of origin. Right. So I use the term religious instead, because to my mind, all humans are religious. Mm-hmm. And a religious person, I would say, is someone who, first of all, adopts a large story, a mythos, something that tells them how things are and which things matter, and is kind of their guiding set of principles. And this story, this narrative, is then approached in three ways. One, called interpretive, that's what does the story mean, what does it tell me about life and the meaning of life and death and all the big sort of philosophical existential questions. The second is how does the story make me feel? So those are internal responses to the story that I would call spiritual. So awe, gratitude, wonder, humility, reverence, spiritual, emotional terms.
Yeah.
And then the third is the outward term, the communal, the moral, the ethical. How does this story guide my relations with others and with the rest of the planet? And in the case of religious naturalist orientation, we also have a term called eco-morality or ego, where the idea is that our moral engagement is not only with other humans, but with other creatures and with the planet as a whole.
Yeah.
So does that get you where you want to
be? That was incredibly helpful. I would like to ask, though, I think I understand why the terminology, and even your explanation, is kind of an indication that these terms need significant qualification, because they carry cultural cachet. And even mm-hmm. just now, even though I've soaked myself in your material, somehow I didn't pick up on kind of the nuances of those terms and recognizing that those shifts and changes. So one of the questions that has emerged is, does it feel to you sometimes like you're fighting a losing battle? Because the next question, sorry, I'm going to load them in here two at a time here. Because the next question that I have is, while you might call it religious naturalist orientation, there are loaded in, at least what I read, some pretty significant philosophies about the nature of the world, about the nature of religion as well. So help me navigate kind of the posture of orientation, or am I mistaken in reading some of those philosophies?
I'm not sure I'm following you. So what I just gave was my understanding of the adjective religious as to what it means. And then where I didn't go is that if one is a religious naturalist, then this large story is what Loyal Rue gave the term everybody's story. The history of nature, how things are is based on our scientific understandings of the natural world and the cosmos.
Right.
And so we, the religious naturalist, then has interpretive, spiritual, and moral responses to this very large story. So that's where the science and the religion come together. Now, did that help with your question?
Well, maybe it's best to just extrapolate some of these ideas. And that was one of the questions I wanted to get to. When you say mythos, I mean, that comes from, religious context, or a religious idea, or so it's within that religious category. And that's what a mythos is. You just explained it, and I would love for you to share a little bit more. The mythos that religious natural, and it's, I'm going to struggle with that as well, religious naturalist orientation is advocating for, is a mythos that's profoundly grounded in the natural world. And I would love for you to explain, how does a natural world give rise to a mythos, a story? Help us understand and navigate that.
Oh, well, okay. So until quite recently, actually, scientific investigation was siloed. So there were physics departments and geology departments and biology departments and social science departments. And they were each doing their own thing and coming up with their own sets of understandings about their particular field. But what has happened is that there was sort of this realization that all of these things were coming together with a very important umbrella being biological evolution, a larger umbrella being cosmic evolution, and that we actually were, in fact, the recipients via these understandings of a large story, a 13.8 billion year story. And mythos just means a large story. It doesn't have we sometimes talk about myth as something that is maybe true, maybe not, but it doesn't, a mythos just means a narrative. Mm-hmm. And so we have this narrative with incredible sub-narratives within it. And this is the story, the mythos that a religious naturalist is working with and seeking to find its religious potential.
Right. So how would you integrate, or would you, the mythological stories of the religious and spiritual traditions? How does that, because those would be very foundational to a religious person's identity and the shaping of their worldview. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God spoke. You have indigenous stories as well. You have ancient Mesopotamian stories. What is your navigation of a mythos that's profoundly grounded in the cosmological and biological natural world, in a world that has given rise to, and we'll get to emergence, I guess, in a little bit, with these other stories? Because
these stories are all part of nature. I mean, they're not outside of nature.
Ah, yes.
So they are part of what we have come to call culture. So our cultures that we've been creating and building down and modifying continuously include the mythos of thousands of different religions that have come up in thousands of different cultures during human history. And so they all have merit, I guess you would say. They're all real. They all exist. They all are open to our curiosity, our interpretation, and then we go from there. We take these stories, particularly the ones that we've grown up with and are most familiar with and influenced our lives most deeply, and we, if we're religious naturalists, we take those stories and we look for what they tell us and what they, where they don't fit into this larger story that we've adopted.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just the teachings of Jesus, the teachings of the Buddha, the indigenous stories and understandings, these are all rich resources for me, and I think for anyone on a religious path.
Right.
The very smart people came up with very wonderful poetry and images and ceremonies and so on, and lucky us to have those to work with.
So this, I think, is a little bit of the question I was asking earlier, that this is a profound shift in a philosophical worldview. And this is, I think, if I can try to articulate this, when we're having cultural debates, or historically we've had cultural debates between religion and science, the religious story in the beginning, God, is usually set up to be a contender with the validity and the truth of a naturalist explanation, Big Bang or evolution, et cetera. And that's been kind of the cultural. What you are saying, and I'm repeating this just so I make sure I understand, what you are saying is that religious mythology is actually embedded in and part of that natural world, and therefore can be accepted, received, engaged with fully and completely for what it is, because it is part of the natural world.
And you can also argue with it, and you can also
right,
which is not true of nature. I mean, nature just is. You can't say I don't like mountains and they go away or something. But but all of the human traditions, and this is not just the religious ones. You know, all of the political traditions, all of the artistic traditions, we're constantly evaluating them, trying to make them better, trying to make them more interesting to us, and so on. So, but they're part of nature.
Yeah. And I think that's what's so stunning to me, is to think about that development. So this is going to get to some other questions then. So let's push this a little bit further. One of the philosophical postulates that exists, that is debated and argued, is that you cannot derive an ought from an is. And you just said it. Nature just is. You can't argue with it because those are the laws of nature. Those are the laws of physics that we are dealing with. Religion and philosophy and ethics, etc., are intrinsically oughts. They provide for us a guidance for how things should be, or a redemption of things that ought not to be, you know, or anything in the middle. I'm kind of curious, how does a religious naturalist respond to or deal with that philosophical postulate that you cannot derive an ought from an is?
Okay, so let me give you two examples. So one is that we have learned from our recent history of the evolution of humans that we come from a very social and lineage, the primates. Everything about primate life is focused around a troop and about the relationships between people in the troop, their friendships, their hierarchies. We are social animals, deeply. And so if we look at the other animals, which would be the is, we see that the other animals work very hard to make sure that their relationships and their social organizations and their troops and their livelihoods are in line, you know, with that they work. Mm-hmm. And so that's an ought. We ought, therefore, to also have our social interactions be operational and, I would say, joyous. Mm-hmm. The second is the larger meta one, that with our scientific understandings, we have come to see how fragile the earth is, how small our place is in the cosmos, that we are blessed to be on this pale blue dot. And so that's the is. And the ought then is that we should take care of the place.
Right? I mean, that's kind of the, yeah. And I guess that's what's so compelling about this is that you don't have to negate. And on both sides, you get the religious side that says that you can't derive an ought from it is. You get a materialist reductionist side that says that there are no such things as morals, or, you know, that we're going to end up in, you know, entropic heat death. So why does anything matter? There is no purpose. You know, it's blind, pitiless purpose, you know, all the way down to the core. Okay, let's pretend you're on a stage with those two people. What does Ursula Goodenough say when you're in a debate like that?
Well, I mean, if we go to purpose, then, of course, purpose is in the eye of the beholder, right? So one can say that seeing all of these stars explode and galaxies collide and everything means that the whole thing is just sort of doesn't have any purpose. And I, for one, have no interest in saying that a collision of galaxies is purposive. So parts of the universe, therefore, I would say it's perfectly fine to say that you don't see any purpose in them. I would go on to say, however, that with the origin of life on our particular planet, and I would say that this would be true also if life evolved on any planet where there were beings that have selves, that one of the things about all life, going all the way back to the very first critter, the origin of life, they do have a purpose. Their purpose is to stay alive, to keep from falling apart, to find resources, to protect themselves, to repair themselves. There's huge purposiveness in all living beings. And so with the origin of life, purpose kind of got invented. Teleology showed up on our planet. And so you can have a purposeless universe and a purposeful planet, or creatures on the planet. And that's not a contradiction. That's just two different scales.
Right. And that's the concept or the idea of emergence, which I don't think I've read it put so succinctly. The something else from the nothing but, right? You have, and that's a really interesting idea to consider, that you can say at some particular level of the universe, sure, there's no purpose in the chemical explosions that created the stars. It was on page 25 and 25 through 36 where you talk about emergence as nature's mode of creativity. All selves have aims. They embody teleology. The advent of selves marks the advent of purpose. So I think that's exactly what you're getting at, is that there's a certain part or point, I suppose, in the emergence of various biological species where self and identity and autonomy take hold, which gives rise to purpose. Again, embedded in the very natural biological state of our universe. My question would be, if somebody were to critique you and say, but this is mere anthropomorphizing of the natural world, the furrowing of your brow shows that I might be on a very wrong path of inquiry here. But this
It's not a wrong path. It's just a path that doesn't make sense because, I mean, if you look at a worm, if you look at a bacterium, if you look at anything, they all have aims and purposes. That you don't have to say that's because they're like me. And in fact, they aren't very much like me in terms of what their aims are and how they go about their lives. So I'm not trying to turn them into human-like critters. I'm just saying that in their very critterhood, they are purposeful.
Yeah, and I think the critique is that it's an imposition of what we think to be purpose upon what is really just a biological process, I suppose. And this is kind of the debate, and this is why I need your help, because this is kind of the debate that I find myself in, is to use any of that particular language is in many ways some sort of concession to intelligence, design, and these things seem to be either heretical or antithetical to a naturalist worldview. And help me, I guess, in that.
Well,
is it as simple as saying it's the emergent properties of the biological world?
What would your person who was my antagonist in the debate, what would they say when, or what would you say when I say that a bacterium has aims? Would you say that's not true, that the bacterium doesn't have aims?
The language
I mean,
that we
having
use.
Aims, having aims, importantly, having aims doesn't mean that you're aware of those aims.
Yeah.
Being a self doesn't mean that you're aware of being a self. And I mean, that's what humans do, is we're aware of these things. We have language, we give them names like aims and purposes. But that doesn't mean that they don't exist, even if we humans aren't around right. to name them.
Yeah.
And so an aim is a goal, trying to get somewhere. And all critters have goals,
yeah.
the chief one being to stay alive. Right. And then, you know, usually to reproduce is another aim. So that's independent of any language or nouns that we have to describe what they're doing.
Right. Yeah, you mentioned on page 113 this very issue that I think I'm still wrestling with and struggling with, which is why my questions are, I need your help with the questions. Language is not merely a mode of communication. It is also the outward expression of an unusual mode of thought. It's symbolic representation. And I suppose this is what I'm kind of wondering and wrestling with, because aims, purpose, goals, how much of that, and this goes back to my anthropomorphizing question, how much of that is an imposition of intelligence and design upon what should be called, again, this is the interlocutor question, should be called a mere blind, pitiless chemical process. And so even though the biology is saying, I want to stay alive, it's just a chemical process and there's nothing more to it. We shouldn't impose human agency or religious sensibilities upon these things. This is the interlocutor that is in my head.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, humans are also chemical processes.
Yes, yes.
We come from simpler creatures that had chemical processes, and we do some fancy things with our minds that give us this language and stuff, and that's all very well and good. But at the end of the day, our aims are also to stay alive, to keep from falling apart, and that's really the core purpose of the human as well, that we add on these other things like being a movie star or something, that's not, basically we're creatures just like everybody else.
Right. Yeah.
And so we give names to what we do and we give names to what they do, but they do them even if they're not named.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is why I appreciate kind of the incising simplicity of the work that you've done here, is like there's so much imposition of kind of cultural freight or weight to these debates that it doesn't actually have to be much more difficult than the way that you just described it. And that's why I think I so appreciate this work. And getting through all these questions is my way of working out in many ways the arguments and the philosophies that have so taken me over. So
it's great fun to work with you.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Let's go.
Okay, let's keep going. So let's get to one of the philosophies. And one of the philosophies is reductionism. And you mentioned, it was on page 41. Oh, this was really fascinating to me. One explanation for the persistence of vitalism is that it serves as a bulwark to fend off reductionism. Now, we should define our terms for the audience, but vitalism being a belief that there is some sort of spark of life or divine that exists that is separate from the biology or the physiology that is part of who we are that gives us that kind of life. Vitalism is not a scientific theory. Let's state that. But your mention of it, saying that it still persists, the idea of vitalism still continually persisting, serves to fend off reductionism, which to me sounds like religious naturalist orientation would also be against a reductionist worldview. Am I correct, or how would you explain that? Help me understand.
Okay. So you, as a scientist, you want to figure out how nature works, okay? And so you focus your attention on a particular question that you want to answer, like how does this beetle get its food, let's say. And so to study that question, to try to get answers to your large question, you go ahead and you start reducing the beetle into its mouth, into its digestive system, into its legs, into its breeding seasons. There are all sorts of ways that you can reduce the beetle into its component parts. And you do that very much like an analogy that makes sense to me is like a movie. So a movie has a whole story and everything, but you can also go in and see who the actors are and where what they are doing and how they're interacting in order to generate the story of the movie. And the scientist will figure out these various features of the beetle in order to get to better understand the something else, which is the beetle itself. Mm. So the beetle itself can be understood in this reductionist sense, and is best understood in this reductionist sense if you want to really get it right. Mm-hmm. You need to know the parts. But that doesn't mean that the parts are telling you about what the beetle is. The parts are telling you how the beetle gets to be the way it is. Mm-hmm. This whole fear of reductionism, and if people are reduced, that means that they're not really alive or something like that, which is what I was getting at with the fending off reductionism, doesn't need to be there at all. You can just say, okay, I'm going to reduce just to find out what this is, and then I'm going to go back to something else, and I'm going to enjoy the beetle and marvel at its emergence.
Yeah, it feels to me like some of what you did in this work, and I felt it while I was reading it, is that a lot of these things are just nothing burgers. that's kind of the summary of it, yeah. Right? Like the amount of mental energy and cultural energy we spend debating these things are really, it's kind of debating nonsense. It is kind of a little bit of what you're suggesting, like reductionism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, we do reductionism all the time. You know, your car doesn't start, right? So you go out and you try to figure out, you know,
right,
have I run out of gas? Is my battery dead? And you, right, you know, do these component efforts, because that's how you figure out how things work.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that you don't appreciate the car.
Right.
And you don't say that the battery is the only thing that's important about your car.
Yeah, it's a very functional, pragmatic kind of approach. Page 58, you're right. Reductionism is not the only operation that scientists know how to perform, as some people seem to believe. But reductionism, here's the key quote, reductionism is the operation that constantly monitors whether our understandings work all the way down. We reduce so that we are able to understand what the nothing buts are and what they are doing. And then we synthesize all the way back up.
Right.
Right. And that is, yep, to put reductionism, again, you don't like, I really appreciate the concern and the critique about the isms. Your approach to that was, like I said at the top, very liberating. It's like, wait a second, why are we doing this? So let's talk about religion and spirituality. Throughout this book, on nature, you have prayers, You say, Lord, thy will be done. You have Psalms. What is your framework and understanding? Let me just read on page 60. When my awe at how life works gives way to self-pity because it doesn't work in ways I would have preferred, I call on assent, the age-old religious response to self-pity, as in, why, Lord? Why this? Why me? And then, thy will be done. And how in the world does that make any sense, I suppose? You have a very clearly a naturalist understanding of the operation of the world with the emergent properties and giving rise to selves, but then appealed to a religious sensibility of...
I think you misunderstood the quote, maybe, and maybe I should try to rewrite it if I ever do this again.
Okay, my apologies.
Same, yeah. I'm giving an example of assent as it is expressed in a monotheistic context. So in the monotheistic context, the question then is, why, Lord, why this, why me? And then what the monotheistic traditions tell you to do is to give assent to what the Lord has visited upon you, as in Job or whatever. But I'm not saying that I was saying that assent is something that is throughout the religions, and I also see it as important in a religious naturalist orientation.
I see.
Particularly when one is bummed out and one wishes that one didn't have to die or get sick or something like that. You give assent not to the Lord's will or the Lord's plan or something like that, but to the fact that we live in a natural world and we are mortal, and there are pathogens that infect us, and there are all sorts of things that we have to give assent to.
So this assent is not a theological orientation. I mean, and that's part of the challenge of reading through some of this stuff. You are not making a theological assertion or claim.
Absolutely
you,
not.
You are simply pointing out that within the religious traditions, the posture of assent and in many ways submission is very much the same kind of posture and approach that one would take as a religious naturalist. Did I say that correctly?
Correctly. Yes, absolutely. And I think it's a very important piece for all of us, whether religious naturalist or not, to give assent to the fact that we are, you know, not in control. There are earthquakes and hurricanes and so on, and to give assent to the natural world that from which we evolved. And to not wish that it could be something else, because it isn't going to be.
Well, and let me take it one step further. Is it true that a religious naturalist would not necessarily be offended or contradictory to somebody who did appeal to a theological premise, because they are also part of the natural world and religious sensibilities arise out of our biology?
I don't call myself an atheist, because atheists have a belief. They believe there's no God. So I looked for another word, because I don't have a belief in whether there's a God or not. I'm basically not interested in the question, if that makes sense to you. My religious sensibilities don't include a God. I don't see that they need a God. I am completely gobsmacked by all the stuff that is in my religious life.
Right.
And the God language gets in the way.
Right.
But that's not true. A lot of people don't feel that way. A lot of people are convinced, either some of them have had experiences that they interpret as being interactions with God, or their traditions tell them that there's a God, and they have faith that those are correct. And the last thing in the world I'm interested in is having my life be spent trying to talk people out of their beliefs in God, if that's what works for them.
Right.
But I'm also speaking to a lot of people that don't have those beliefs,
right,
and trying to help them see that because they don't have those beliefs does not mean that they aren't religious, which so many people tell me, well, yeah, I'm not religious because I don't believe in God. That doesn't parse for me.
Yeah, I think that's a really clear outcome of the work that you are attempting to advance in the world, which I think is really, really powerful in many ways, because it gives a lot of people freedom and permission in many ways to be in touch with that part of themselves that is spiritual or religious or what have you, without necessarily needing to appeal to the theological precepts that come along with the modern concept, or not the modern concept, the historical concepts of religion that have been around. I suppose I didn't ask my question very well. My question is, in many ways, not so much do you as a religious naturalist make room for people who have theological beliefs. I guess my question is, does the worldview of religious naturalism recognize religious beliefs as part of that natural world, and therefore it's not in contradiction? If somebody did believe in a God, because the religious naturalist orientation recognizes that the development of religion and culture is part of the natural world, then there's no contradiction. It makes sense that some sort of religious ascent would happen within our species as part of our biological evolution. Therefore, there's no need to contradict or fight or argue, like what you said is you're just not interested in.
Right. I'm just not interested in doing that. And it's important to keep in mind that whether I write a book or whatever I or anybody else says, this belief in a supernatural God who performs miracles and so on isn't holding up well. Okay. At least, I mean, it's still is a mainstay in Islamic cultures, for example, but in Christian and Judaic traditions, it's really not doing great.
Yeah.
And so for people that where it's important, I mean, of course, go for it. It's not going to help. And the other thing I think it's really important to say is something I say toward the end of the book, and maybe you don't want to go there very much, but to say that the example I use is it's a river cleanup, and there are some people who go to the river cleanup because the river is God's creation, and they are stewards of what God created. And there are other people who go to the river cleanup because the river has spirits in it that are going to be angry if the river is dirty. And then there's me. I go there because the river's part of the earth, and I want to live in a healthy earth and have a healthy earth for us all.
Yeah.
We're there for different reasons, but that doesn't mean that we don't all get our hands and knees and start, you know, pulling out the invasive weeds.
Mm-hmm.
You can have this difference in your, this overall philosophical perception of how things are, and still join together in very important ways.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to ask if you have any familiarity with what I'm understanding to be some new scientific understanding suggesting that consciousness may be more fundamental than the material world. This is coming out of physics and a little bit of cosmology, some quantum theory, et cetera. First, I guess I should ask, do you have any familiarity with that? Because my question would be, what would that do, or what would that imply for religious naturalist orientation?
Well, nobody understands how consciousness works, and so there are scientists, there are neurologists, there are neurophysicists, there are people who study brains who are trying very hard to figure out how they work, but it's not the case. I don't think anybody says that they understand how it works. there are theories and people test them, and the theories, you know, the tests, we have a lot of information about what the brain does, but the actual trick of, you know, getting a thought out of meat, if you will, is still to be pursued. I think it's important. Let me just add this little thing that if you woke up tomorrow morning and read in the New York Times that people have figured out how it works, and you know that it's the hippocampus interacting with the parietal lobes and the prefrontal cortex, there was all of this stuff, okay,
and we have the math to prove it.
It wouldn't really change your understanding of consciousness at all, because your understanding of consciousness is an experience, and so you're having this experience, and I don't know where you come out, but I certainly am completely convinced that this experience is an emergent property of what hippocampus and parietal lobes are doing. I don't think that it's coming from without, although you may want to start asking me those questions, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't feel immaterial. It feels immaterial. There's no way that I experience all the parts in my brain giving rise to this amazing thing that's happening. Whereas I have no problem with my muscles, you know, being what makes my arm move. That seems pretty material. But yeah, this consciousness stuff is something else.
Yeah. Well, I guess that does beg the question. I would be kind of curious if what role or what understanding of consciousness a religious naturalist would have. And I think part of the discussion, at least the philosophical discussion that's being had, is you mentioned that how do we get a thought out of meat? The literature or the research seems to be indicating that there's evidence that you don't get a thought out of meat. You get meat out of a thought, right? That's generally what some of this stuff is pointing towards.
Well, there are philosophers and there are thinkers who have thoughts like that. The Buddhist tradition, of course, has consciousness being a totally different thing that comes in and out of beings. It's not like there aren't ideas like that. There's Whitehead, that everything is conscious and an atom just has a little teeny bit of it. And if you get something bigger, there's more of it. None of that. The people that put consciousness first, saying that it's always been there or something, to me, that's kind of begging the question. I mean, it's what you're trying to explain. You explain it by saying that it was there at the beginning, and that's not really an explanation in my mind. That's kind of a pun.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in these ideas. I read them, and I say that's an interesting way to put it. But yeah, I don't believe that it's the case that there is any scientific evidence that there is consciousness as something that's independent of material.
Yeah. Okay, we're coming close to time, but I did want to ask you at least one biology question. I asked you a lot of questions on the philosophy and the view and the worldview. I do have a biology question for you because biology is not my forte, so I would love some help with this. You mentioned, speaking of consciousness, you write about the germ-soma dichotomy, about that there's this really interesting dynamic that's going on in our biologies. And then you also mention about how that gives rise or makes possible the idea of brains. And then you also talk about the existence of death providing the conditions for human-style consciousness. And I read over that a couple times. I still don't think I understand fully how all of that works. And I just had, I'm kind of fanboying here. I have this preeminent biologist, and I would just love a verbal explanation.
How much time do we have left?
So, okay.
I tried to explain as clearly as I could in the book, so maybe try it again. But let me, the idea is that one of the imperatives of a self is that it gives rise to more selves. If it doesn't, then it goes extinct and you don't talk about it anymore. So single-celled organisms, they divide it into 2, 4, 8, 16, and there's no death isn't built in to those life cycles. Mm-hmm. They can die, you can boil them, you can kill them. It's not like they're immortal, but they don't have to die. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So then you get to the multicellulars, and the multicellulars have independently in plants and animals come up with a different idea, which is that you have two kinds of cells. One kind of cells forming the germline, which are given the job of getting the genetic instructions, the genome, to the next generation. Hmm. And then you have other cells that they're called the soma, or the vegetative part in plants, that don't transmit to the next generation. What they do instead is that they form organs, they form tissues, they do stuff. And because they are not constrained to be appropriate for the next generation, they can form all sorts of things, everything that we think about in animals and plants that we look at, except the seeds and the corn cobs are the soma. And one of the things about animal somas is that they got this particular kind of nervous system called, that it's brain-based. And so the soma in animals has a brain, and soma in us has the brain. So the germline takes things to the next generation. The soma can differentiate anything it wants to, but eventually, because it's not appropriately configured to keep on going, it dies. And that means that our brains are destined to die. And then in the reflection, I point out that it's very poignant that we are, as humans, seem to be the only ones who really know that we're going to die. And yet it was the invention of the germ soma dichotomy that allowed us to have brains in the first place so that we could have these thoughts.
And that is...
Is that the, any better?
No, I'm... You know, it might just be...
Are you getting it?
Getting, like, getting told multiple times over, it starts to set different kinds of things. It's the idea, and because I am really profoundly interested in consciousness and the biological mechanism that you explained, that you just explained, for giving rise to human-style consciousness, seems to be some sort of biological iteration of these realities. So if death is imminent and is going to happen, I suppose, and we already have, because of the germ soma dichotomy, we have these brains, the cognitive mechanism of recognizing death, am I getting this right? The cognitive mechanism of recognizing death is kind of the catalyst for what we call human style consciousness, awareness. Is that?
Oh no, I don't. I don't think it's causative. I would just say that there are all sorts of kinds of somas, okay. But they all include brains, and so brains are dying all over the place. Beetle brains and giraffe brains and grasshopper brains. They're all destined to die because they're part of the somatic part. Mm-hmm. What's different about our brains is that we have these minds that, have language and stuff like that. And so we can actually, we notice and we tell stories about people who die, and we aren't happy about that.
Right. Yeah, that emotional component is just definitely going to wreak havoc.
And I mean, there are certainly, I'm convinced that when there's certain animals, apes and elephants and others that are sad when a child dies. So it's not like they don't notice that a being whom they cared about is no longer there. They get upset and they carry the bodies around and so on.
Right.
But that doesn't mean, to my mind, that there's any evidence that the elephant has an existential understanding that it too will die.
Right.
Whereas we humans all do.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to keep pounding away at this consciousness thing for the rest of my life, as I'm sure all of us will be.
Remember, there are two kinds of consciousness in humans. One is just the basic consciousness that everybody else has, and the other is this I self. That makes us different also.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You've been incredibly generous with your time. I would like for you to close us out with the confession of a credo of continuation and what that means and what we should do about it. Because it feels to me like religious naturalist orientation is not just a worldview or not just a posture towards some, it is actually some way of being that cares deeply about our existence, our biology. You mentioned the eco-consciousness, etc. So what is the credo of continuation to which you confess, and what would you leave us with as far as like an exhortation? Basically, Ursula,
asking you... You have the book in front of you. You can read it.
I could, but I want to hear it. I want to hear it from you. I'm basically asking you to give us a sermon at the end.
Let's see. Evolution is often thought about as being about prevalence, about how many copies there are of which kinds of genomes. But it is quite as accurate, and I believe far more germinative, to think of evolution as being about the continuation of organisms. Genomes that provision organisms with instructions that lead to well-being are found in future organisms. Key adaptations that generate well-being include awareness, evaluation, and purpose, features that were doubtless present in primordial cells. In order to continue, genomes must specify organisms that are aware of their environmental circumstances, evaluate these inputs correctly, and respond with intentionality. And so, I profess my faith, capital F. For me, the existence of all this biological complexity and awareness and intent and beauty and relationship embedded in its wondrous planetary matrix serves as the ultimate meaning and the ultimate value. The continuation of life reaches around, grabs its own tail, and forms the sacred circle that requires no further justification, no creator, no superordinate meaning, no purpose, capital P purpose, other than the continuation continue until the earth collapses into the sun or the final meteor collides. I confess a credo of continuation.
That's really beautiful. How would you exhort?
And in doing
us?
So, I confess as well a credo of human continuation. Can I do that?
Absolutely.
Do I turn?
Of course.
We may be the only questioners in the universe, the only ones who have come to understand the astonishing dynamics of cosmic and biological evolution. If we are not, if there are others out there who, capital K, know, it is highly unlikely that we will ever encounter one another. We are also, for better or worse, the dominant species and hence the stewards of this planet. If we can revere how things are and can find ways to express gratitude for our existence, then we should be able to figure out, with a great deal of work and goodwill, how to take care of the place, how to share the planetary matrix with other creatures, how to restore and preserve its elegance and grace, and how to commit ourselves to love and joy and laughter and hope. Yeah. It goes back in the end to my father's favorite metaphor. Life is a coral reef. We each leave behind the best, the strongest deposit we can so that the reef can grow. But what's important is the reef.
Yeah, that's really beautiful and wonderful.
Thank you.
I would like to add, since we're doing a book reading, just one additional piece, because for many in my community, religion is still very central to their lives. And then, so one page later, you say, I love traditional religions. Once we have our understandings and feelings about nature and place, then I believe we can also find ways to call ourselves Buddhist or Christian or Confucian or Taoist or Hindu or Hopi. Sorry, I might have pronounced that wrong. Hopi or Jew Hopi. Or Hopi. It is Hopi. My apologies. Or mm-hmm. Jew or Muslim or some of each. The words in the traditional text may sound different to us than they did to their authors, but they often continue to resonate with our religious selves. We know what they are intended to mean. And I feel like that is a wonderful summation, a credo of continuation, a credo of human flourishing and continuation with a synthesis of the religious traditions and recognizing what they mean. I'm so sorry, I was going to say one more question, but I was kind of curious. Did you grow up religious? And is this newfound religious naturalist orientation a challenge or just a continuation of your upbringing? I'm just kind of curious.
Oh, well, I mean, there is autobiographical stuff in the book. Basically, my dad grew up in a strictly Methodist Victorian tradition, became a minister and then lost his faith, as they say, and got a PhD and became a professor studying the history of religion. So religion was therefore always something that in my household was considered to be important and worthy of study and worthy of respect. But I wasn't, and Dad used to, you know, play the Methodist hymns on the piano and sing them loudly, so I know the words to them all. But there was never any effort to indoctrinate me, as you will, into that faith tradition. And so until I happened on some people who put this idea of a religious naturalist orientation into my head, I just assumed I wasn't religious.
Yeah. My friends, the book is The Sacred Depths of Nature. My guest, Ursula Goodenough. I am tremendously honored. Thank you so much for accepting my invitation. I think this is really profound. I thank you for going to the mat with me on the philosophy and wrestling out some of this stuff and helping me and others to understand that there's a way forward to navigate all of the varieties of understanding our world. That is really profound and beautiful and a wonderful synthesis. And to be both scientific and religious is not only possible, it's beautiful and it's wonderful. And you've given us a way to do so that holds on to our intellectual integrity, but also our spiritual and religious selves. And I so appreciate your articulation of that because it is a wonderful invitation for people in a very contentious world where I only want this and I don't want that, and you have to argue everything. So you've really given us a beautiful way forward, and I thank you so much for that. I think that's a phenomenal gift, and I hope more and more people get on board with this rather than some people that waited a quarter century to find you. So Ursula, thank you so much for joining
us. I'm honored by your tribute, and it's been a pleasure having this conversation.
Thanks so much.
Hope we have others.
I appreciate it. Thank you, everybody.
I'll try to find you when I'm next out.
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
We could go out drinking.
Oh, my goodness. Well, unfortunately, I don't drink. I'll have a soda. I'll have something with you.
All right.
But we'll go out and drink. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.